Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC. It's time for our dive into the news, and with me is our Head of National Ministries, Adrian Reynolds. Good morning, Adrian.
Good morning, Phil.
And our Head of National National Director, John Stevens. Let me get it right. Good morning, John.
Hi, Phil.
And I can exclusively reveal that one of us has got tickets for Burton Albion versus Bolton Wanderers next weekend, but I will leave
you
in
suspense.
Well,
you're pointing to us too. You're saying one of us.
No, one of us. The three of us. I won't say who it was, but one of us.
I've got tickets for Fleetwood Shack. The Fleetwood Mac tribute band.
Brilliant.
Coming to Harborough.
Brilliant. Brothers, let's talk about what's been going on in the news. Now, I think I'm right in saying this, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. I think there's a new US president. Is that a fair comment?
Well, since we last recorded?
Yeah, No. We just got the feeling that he's dominating the headlines somewhat. And we want to be clear, this is not going to be a Donald Trump podcast, but it's interesting because there is clearly a shift, isn't there, in the way that people are talking globally. What does it mean to be populist? What's the populist vote, all that kind of stuff is kind of weaving its way through the news, isn't it?
What does it mean to be expansionist?
Yeah, all of that.
America first.
Yeah. So there will be kind of, we'll pick up points of that, but it won't be a Donald Trump podcast. So I'm just warning you of that as okay. We begin. But let's start with sobering news that it's the third anniversary since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We've marked that this last couple of weeks and the hostilities are still going on. Donald Trump has done his bit to try and bring that to a conclusion, but in a remarkably strange way in terms of how he's engaged with that. It is sobering. So many people have lost their lives, and it suddenly seems to be being dealt with in a rather flippant way.
We ought to say it's longer than 3 years since Crimea was invaded.
Okay, yeah.
So actually this conflict has been going on longer than the 3 years. So the 3 years since the most recent incursion by Russia. But of course, there was the shooting down of the plane and there was also the invasion of Crimea before that. So this has been going on longer. But yes, you're absolutely right. In our eyes, the kind of the current conflict seems to have, you could date it back 3 years and it is the anniversary. And I think it's very sad to see all that's happened. You know, something that you might have thought was just a kind of flash in the pan, as in, you know, it would be sorted out quite quickly, has become long and intractable. There's no clear superiority on either side. It's difficult to see how either side is really going to win in a sort of classic sense. And so it looks like the most likely outcome is some kind of compromise. And that kind of has questions about, you know, justice and what's right. And I mean, it's very difficult to talk about. And I think perhaps more than other conflicts around the world, it's been very personal for us in the sense that lots of Ukrainians have come to the UK.
Settled in our churches.
And settled in our churches. Yeah. Remarkably so, really, and in extraordinary ways. And we found that not just in our small church, and lots of other churches will have experiences of that. So I think this... It's not just geographically immediate, it's personally immediate to us. Most of us know Ukrainians. That's the reality. Whereas actually, you know, you hear about something that's happening in Yemen, for example. No, not many of us, I doubt, know Yemenis. So it feels a lot more closer to home. And of course, it is on the borders of Europe. But despite that, it feels closer to home. So yes, I think we should keep remembering Ukrainians. And Russians caught up in this too, I think, and especially believers. You know, we're concerned for all of the world and we're to do good to all the world, but especially those who belong to the family of God. And actually, this has had a profound impact, both in good and bad ways, upon the church in Ukraine and in the church in Russia. You know, evangelical believers have really suffered in the clampdown in Russia. And, you know, evangelical believers have suffered in Ukraine, but at the same time, there's been a remarkable, almost a revival, really. So alongside all the geopolitics that are going on and which we lament and long for there to be a just solution, there's actually been a remarkable work of God. And so all these things are kind of coming at us. And I find it quite difficult sometimes just to disentangle all of that stuff. You know, on the one hand, you want to be thinking about what's right for Ukraine and what would be justice for Ukraine. On the other hand, you're hearing about, you know, young leaders being raised up and churches multiplying and churches being planted, especially in Ukraine. And your heart rejoices at that and thinks that's an opportunity that wouldn't otherwise have come. And I just think within all of that, therefore, is the perplexity of the sovereignty of God, that God is over all these things. And in ways that we can't fully explain and understand, but we believe by faith that God is the God of the universe. God is the God in some way of Trump, of Putin, of Zelensky, of Ukraine, of Russia, of the church, and is causing his purposes to be worked out.
There has been this incredible shift in tone, though, hasn't there, John? In terms of under the Biden administration, it was very clear the support for Ukraine was unequivocal. That has changed in recent times, with even an extraordinary comment that maybe Ukraine was somehow responsible when Russia is clearly the aggressor. I find that just remarkable and very difficult to hear. How do we respond to that kind of misinformation? Because that's what that is. That is misinformation, which needs calling out. Russia is the aggressor.
Russia is the aggressor in that they invaded Ukraine 3 years ago. I mean, I think the whole situation is tragic, and obviously sort of hundreds of thousands of people have lost their lives. Adrian's already talked about the remarkable way churches have responded, the generosity. Actually, Ukraine, we mustn't forget, is the Bible Belt of Eastern Europe, and God has richly blessed Ukraine. It's been interesting hearing different tones from American missionaries in Ukraine speaking about the situation on the ground. I do think we need to be careful to remember that it's all too easy to be an armchair diplomat, an armchair strategist, not to know what the conversations really are that are happening behind at the scenes. So there are some things that President Trump have said that he's backed away from. I mean, yesterday's comment about, did I say he was a dictator?
I don't think I did. So, yeah.
Actually, how to relate to somebody who deals very differently on the international stage is, I think, quite hard. So everybody says Trump says things but doesn't mean it. There's a difficulty of how do you actually engage with somebody who you can't quite take their words at face value in terms of not knowing quite what's going on. Who knows what conversation has been had with President Putin behind the scenes. But there does seem to be a change. I mean, wonderful. I think we ought to have a measure of positivity that there does seem to be some discussion about bringing the conflict to an end. And you say Joe Biden was committed in his support to Ukraine. Well, he was, but didn't give them enough to actually enable them to really win the victory. So we are in this situation in which it's been a conflict that has become static, become bogged down. Probably people have recognized for a long time, conflicts like this have to be resolved with some kind of deal that in the end will not give either side absolutely everything that they would want. That's happened in all sorts of places around the world. And the reality is the West is not going to enable Ukraine to be armed to win and reconquer everything, nor is it going to allow Russia to be able to kind of take over Ukraine in the way that it would want to. So at least there's the beginnings of some sort of discussion about that. I mean, obviously, it's right that Ukraine be treated fairly and justly. I think, actually, interestingly, the Europeans being forced to step up is, again, a very significant development that people are responding to. So I think we ought to hope that out of this, no matter what the public mood, message, and music might be, a genuinely fair kind of resolution to the conflict that brings peace might be brought about. And as I said, we don't actually know everything that's happening behind the scenes of what's being negotiated, what people are prepared to give. We're watchers in on that, and I think we have to, as Adrian was saying, trust God and trust God's sovereignty in that situation and pray that a right resolution will be brought about. And actually, just at our individual level, to keep on supporting Ukraine and those who are suffering. I'm going to a meeting in Parliament this week of a charity that basically provides aid and support to Ukraine that's kind of run by Christians, has a hugely significant impact. The Ukrainian ambassador is attending that and has been hugely appreciative of the work that's been done. So churches and Christians still have this massive opportunity to care for individuals, for churches, for our brothers and sisters in Ukraine and in Russia. That's the difference that we can make. And I think sometimes there's a danger of us playing geopolitics, which we're not really able to influence, and actually then not doing the things that as a Christian community we really can do tangibly in terms of praying, supporting, giving, for the work of the gospel.
There's something in there, isn't there, about how we invest. So you've mentioned there about Europe being asked to invest more in its own defence and not having America kind of covering its back. There's lessons there for leaders, isn't there? We need to invest properly in our work to make sure that we're putting the appropriate things in place.
Yeah, I mean, you can't, this isn't just in monetary terms, but you can't do church on the cheap. By which I mean, if your sermon is just produced on a Sunday morning, half an hour before it's due, and if your prayer meeting is kind of a snatched 5 minutes on Zoom somewhere, and if your training for people to serve is basically, I'll just watch this online video, you'll be fine. I think church will inevitably suffer. It requires investment, and that means time. And I think that's the challenge for us as church leaders, is that we are deploying in church an army of volunteers And we probably have more time than other people in the church. I mean, some people listening to this will be lay leaders, some people be bivocational, but leaders often have more disposable time than people in the church, and people are very stretched. So I think helping people to see the value of investment, to see how much it pays off. And actually, I think little changes can make big differences. I think that's also true in geopolitics, by the way. It doesn't all need to be massive stuff. Sometimes little changes can make big differences. And I think that's also true in church life.
I think it's easy for people to be offended by Donald Trump's tone, but yet there are some things he says that are really important that are being taken notice of. And I think it is true that Europe has not invested in its own defence in the way that it should have done, as expected America to be there to be able to kind of provide the backstop. And suddenly that's not being offered in the same way, because America is turning its attention more to the Pacific and to the threat of China. So there is that sense in which countries are suddenly having to face the fact we've got to take responsibility for ourselves. And I think that is an important principle. It is all too easy to assume that others will underwrite you and then not to make the significant decisions that you have to make. And in the end, resources are always limited and you've got to choose where to invest those resources in the best and the most important sort of way. I think that does have implications for churches and ministry. We can assume that somebody else will bankroll everything. You see that in church planting. I mean, we can say there's an analogy in lots of people chasing money from the states to fund church plants and grow work and appoint workers. In the end, you have to be able to develop self-sustaining ministry that's able to fund itself and provide for its own needs. So I think there are realities that need to be faced up to. And European governments seem to be actually facing up to that. And what's been remarkable is the degree of rapid change in terms of what European countries are choosing to do. I mean, Poland has been investing its defence very heavily for several years. Those nearer the border have done that more quickly, but others are now recognising they have to take responsibility for themselves.
But I think it's also interesting that that requires difficult decisions. So the increase in spending in defence in the UK is going to come from the aid budget.
And that's been very badly received.
Well, it has been badly received. I mean, if you look at what the aid budget is sometimes spent on, you can think that's just mad. So aid is very loosely defined and sometimes goes into things that as Christians we wouldn't want to support, or even as non-Christians people wouldn't want to support. So I think aid is, it is a bit of a black pit, and some of it where it goes is not particularly helpful. So, but there are always trade-offs, aren't there, in leadership? And I think it's pretty clear that Europe has been provoked into this response by Trump, which I think probably is quite an astute move on his part. He's difficult to read, isn't he, Trump? You know, the two extreme caricatures of Trump is either that he's completely stupid or he's a wily deal maker. I think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle, as it is for all of us. But he has provoked a response. And I think there's some interesting lessons there for us. You know, if you want to get things done in church life, how do you make them happen? Well, one way is to provoke people into doing stuff and to serving people. And I sort of,
is that the right way?
Well, I don't think it is. No. I mean, I think we need to be careful about saying that church leadership is exactly the same as political leadership in the world. They're not the same thing. And if Trump gets results, then his approach is validated to some extent. But it seems to me that in gospel terms we're to renounce secret and shameful ways. So I think we've got to be very careful as leaders about manipulating things to get the result we want, to provoking people to serve. I'm just thinking, you could have a church meeting where you want to get a very difficult decision through, and you could almost blackmail people or provoke people or even say things you know aren't quite true in order to get the result you want. It'd be very easy for leaders to do that. And I think it's very tempting. So we've just got to be careful that we are straightforward and honest in our leadership. And that might mean sometimes that things take longer. I mean, Trump has, he's only been president for 2 minutes and he's getting things done. So obviously this kind of approach is getting results. And I think we've got to be a little bit cautious in church life thinking that we want immediate results and therefore the means don't matter, the end matters. That's simply not the Bible way.
One of the things I was going to say, I mean, Jesus in his ministry did sometimes expose things with shocking language and the ways that he kind of confronted some of the established.
Yes, but he always said things he believed.
Yeah, absolutely. But exactly. So there's a difference between how you might say about things and actually whether you really believe those things. Yeah. And I do think we're called to be Christ-like in the way that we lead. And it seems to me that it's at kind of the very heart of something of the character of God is the truthfulness of his word. He says what he means truthfully. There isn't that sense of you have to listen to God's word and think, well, he doesn't really mean that. Mm. Actually, God is always truthful and straightforward. Yeah, yeah. He is also immutable in that he doesn't change. And his character is unchanging. And that is absolutely the basis on which we can trust that God will be faithful and he will commit to us. And when he is committed to us, he will not change that commitment. He is not an unreliable ally who is going to suddenly change his view and his opinion. And I think some of the kind of fear that's been developed has been about comments about NATO, Article 5, things that have been agreed and whether or not those can still be trusted. Well, what we know with God is he never sort of changes, breaks his commitment and is unfaithful. And that's what makes him so utterly reliable. And I think as leaders, we're meant to reflect that in the way that we speak, in the way that we keep our commitments.
One of the things that Trump's election has done is led to a kind of focus on global populism, if I can put it like that. So what does it mean to receive the popular vote in elections or whatever that looks like? And I think what's interesting is we've seen the growth of the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship. This is a conference that takes place, conservative leaning. A number of Christians were in attendance at that over the last couple of weeks. Some part of our churches who were in the audience there. Glenn Scriven has done a really kind of helpful podcast on that, which we can link in the show notes. But what I think is really interesting for churches and church leaders is here you've got a bunch of people who are speaking in kind of Christian ways, using some of the language we might use about the family, about the ways in which we think a country should operate, but they're not Christian. What's good in that? What should we be cautious about in that? I wonder if we could reflect on that for a couple of minutes.
Well, I wasn't there. I've picked up some of the reports on it. The ARC conference has been brought together, particularly by Baroness Philippa Stroud, who's a Christian. I mean, at one level, Philippa and her husband, David, have been involved in a variety of ministries and initiatives trying to, in a sense, bring about a Christian renewal in society. Mm-hmm. They organized the Everything conference and events, which is basically a Christian, encouraging and supporting Christians in all areas of public life, which I think is very positive. I've been to that a number of times. ARC is trying to bring some of those things into the more public sphere where it can't quite be conducted on a purely Christian basis, but is a desire to want to recapture some of the Judeo-Christian foundations of Western civilization. Mm. And it's brought together a whole variety of people who've got concerns about the desire to recapture those foundations for civic and public life, some of whom are Christians, some of whom are not Christians. I don't think that Trump has created the rise of populism. That's been happening across countries.
Well, he's a result of it, is what I'm
saying.
He's
partly a result of it. But his election in the States has given confidence to those who are sort of more of a populist view that there is the potential to be able to obtain power. I mean, we saw that with the kind of hopes from some that the ADF in Germany would make very significant steps. Of course, they increased their vote, but not by the degree that people might have talked about. So populism hasn't necessarily broken into the political mainstream. I think the things they're saying about the nature of society, many Christians would agree with those, issues connected with the family, security. Lots is bound up with the question of the nature of culture and the challenge to the culture of immigration and people coming with very different worldviews that are not orientated on a Judeo-Christian basis. How does a society incorporate widely divergent views? So I think there's concern about the nation state, actually an emphasis on the nation state rather than a kind of a globalist world system. And lots of those things I think Christians absolutely resonate with, and it's reflecting policy concerns that lots of Christians have had for a period of time. I think the challenge is it brings together those who are genuinely Christian with those who have a sort of Christian values outlook. Now, maybe that's what's needed in order to bring about public policy change. But it is interesting that you've got people on both sides of the spectrum. So you've got some people like Jordan Peterson, who's well known for his kind of psychoanalysis and psychology and views, but would not be a committed Christian, but would buy into certain aspects of a Christian worldview. And then you've got others who are speaking who are committed Christians. I think Amy Ewing spoke, and I think Oz Guinness also. And I think his contribution seemed to me to be particularly significant. He basically said, in the end, you can't have Judeo-Christian values without Judeo-Christian faith. Mm. I think he probably was highlighting something really significant, that whilst you might be able to gather people around certain public policy positions, in the end, it is Christian faith that generates those values. Yeah. So I think in society at the moment, there's a mood on the part of some that they're recognizing the loss of turning away from Judeo-Christian faith and things that we've taken for granted, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, cultural identity, all those are then lost if you lose that foundation. People like Tom Holland and others are highlighting that. The question is whether or not you can recover that without actually having the faith that underlies it. And I think that's where the tension is. So as a Christian, I might want many of those values to be reflected in public life. But if they're not accompanied by Christian faith, some of those values can become distorted on their own. Because across the left and right spectrum, the left and right both reflect certain aspects of Christian kind of values and outlook. And it seems to me neither of them holistically reflects the biblical balance. And the danger is if you try to have it without the Christian faith, you will have a distorted model rather than a more holistic kind of model. So I think that recognition that to have the values, you need the faith is an absolutely crucial and important element to bear in mind.
Can it lay the foundations, Adrian, for evangelism if people are thinking in a more, what we might say, traditional Christian way, regardless of the right-left divide that John describes? If there's many things there that we would agree with, does that help create a space where people perhaps would be more open to the gospel, or am I overreaching?
I think you're overreaching slightly. I think what happens in evangelism, especially in personal evangelism, is making points of connection. Dan Strange is very good at this. He was at the Art Conference, although I haven't heard from him what he made of it. So his book about making faith magnetic is very helpful on this. I think that basically you're trying to find points of contact, points of connection. So for example, if people are looking at the country and sort of seeing, you know, how it's going and thinking what's going on, that suddenly you've got a point of connection there. So I think there's a kind of an apologetic argument for saying, well, how do we introduce the topic of the gospel? So I think it does that. I'm not sure it makes the ground more fertile on the whole. I think I'm slightly more cynical about that in the sense, well, I'm slightly more scriptural about it, let's say, in the sense that it's a spiritual darkness actually that's over people. And I think that has to be overcome in a number of ways. And I think historically it's been clear that Satan has used nominalism as a very effective deterrent against the gospel. So I think actually a little Christianity without the full gospel can sometimes have the opposite effect.
Yeah, it can people inoculate us, if you like.
Yes. Yeah, but it's always a spiritual task. And it's always about waking the dead, isn't it? But I think it does give us points of connection.
I think I see apologetics as an element of Jenga and Lego in apologetics. Apologetics is partly...
Hang on a minute. Jenga and Lego.
Jenga is knocking down arguments that prevent people believing the Christian faith. So you're kind of trying to knock the bricks down until a whole edifice collapses. And then you're trying to rebuild something else in its place. I think it does have a place in doing a bit of that work of Jenga. I think we're in a culture at the moment in which lots of people have come to the view that Christianity is basically bad. Christianity is the problem. That's been the sort of liberal progressive position. And I think what this does is it can helpfully show that that is not true, that historically many of the things that we think are good in society are actually a result of kind of Christian influence and Christian faith. And I think people like Glenn Scrivener, people like Sharon James, who've charted out some of the kind of historic Christian contribution to our society, that has the effect of knocking out some of the objections that people might have of Christianity. That's helped by people like Tom Holland and others. That in and of itself is not enough to bring people to faith, but it actually, there is a purpose there of helping to confront some of the arguments that some people might have about Christianity.
I'm a bit more cynical about that, John, but I think most people, so I think a conference like the Art Conference is attracting a certain group of people who are thinking a certain way. Maybe we just mix, you know, I go line dancing, you go to lawyers' meetings. So maybe you're just meeting
I'll
people.
I'll be at Burton Albion.
Maybe you're meeting people who are more thoughtful about the world. I don't think on the whole people are thinking at that level.
Well, I think, I mean, there's a question, that there are all sorts of different people who need to be reached in different ways, which needs to be contextualization. I think they have a particular view of reaching the intellectual elite and have a vision of how the conversions of people like a C.S. Lewis might then have an overflow into society more widely. So they're working at a particular section of society where those arguments may have more impact. I agree, those don't necessarily work in
my neighbours don't
context.
Seem to be saying, you know, Christianity has been an evil, to give me some arguments for why that's not been the case.
Although I do think that we need to recognise that lots and lots of people who are not in that kind of intellectually elite group, particularly young men, are listening to Jordan Peterson, they're listening to people like Andrew Tate and others, they're buying into a certain outlook and worldview, and we need to recognise that, and that both is something that perhaps needs to be challenged, but also something that gives opportunity resources to be able to speak into that situation.
But that's a slightly different point, I think. That's not quite at the same, it seems to me, that's not quite at the same sort of Tom Holland academic level of, you know, looking at the world and looking at it in meta terms. It's much more micro, I think, in terms of who am I and what's my place in the world.
Yeah, although it does touch into, particularly in that area, I think men, how do men fit into contemporary society? How are they they regarded? Yeah. So there are some meta questions about the nature of society that are actually playing into those concerns, which are very real concerns. And again, Christians have been pointing those out for a long period of time. And it is an opportunity to bring gospel to bear.
Yes, but their meta questions are still have micro applications rather than, you know, it'd be interesting to look at the sweep of Christian history in the last 200 years and see how Judeo-Christian values. Anyway, there we are.
There we are. Well, one of the things the Art Conference did talk about and touch on was free speech. And there's been a victory for free speech this last couple of weeks. Christy Higgs won her case in the
appeal.
Courts.
Appeal,
I beg your pardon. In the courts after she was fired from her school for posting things on her Facebook page complaining about LGBT stuff in the school.
And a different school.
But interestingly, she won. She was told she was allowed to express those views. She should not have lost her job for that. A victory for free speech.
Well, this case is a little bit more complicated than that, as they always are. You have to read the judgments, don't you, and read into the story. John's, I can see, has got it there.
Got the judgment. He's highlighted bits.
This is kind of radio at its best, isn't it? That actually it's there in front of him. And John's the lawyer. But so I'm interested to know your take on it, John. As I read it, my reading of it was it's more a victory for proportionality rather than free speech per se. Is that a fair assessment, or is it more complicated than that?
I mean, I think it is a good decision. It's a right decision. Mm. It's a right decision for her. She clearly was really badly treated by the school.
So she lost her employment tribunal.
Wrongly said. She lost her employment tribunal.
And then she appealed.
And she's appealed. Yeah. So I think at one level it is a victory for saying that what she did, which was to post on her personal Facebook page her views about transgenderism and sex education in schools, that was not a reasonable ground for dismissing her from her work. And I think at that level, that's really significant.
Yeah.
It provides significant protection to Christians and to others to be able to express their views. It's worth recognising that in English law, there isn't an absolute right to freedom of speech. So you can't say whatever you want, no matter its impact on others. So we shouldn't think of this as some sort of charter for people to say absolutely anything that they want. It's saying that the particular way in which she spoke was not one that justified dismissal from her work. The court is helpful. It does say that freedom of speech means you have the freedom to be able to cause offence to other people in what you believe. So merely offending other people is not a grounds for being restricted in your speech. However, the law does say that there's an issue if you seek to gratuitously offend others. So on issues like, for example, sexuality, there's a difference between stating your opinion and stating it in a way that is intended to give gratuitous offence for offence's sake to people who might be part of the LGBT community. So, there is a balance between when your speech is gratuitously offensive. That may not be enough to justify dismissal in itself. If it is gratuitously offensive, then there's actually a question of what's the proportionate response to that. Mm. And the court here, they didn't decide it was gratuitously offensive. They assumed, even if it was, that this would not have been a proportionate response to what had happened. Because she was reposting somebody else's post, so it wasn't her language. There was no evidence at all that the school's reputation had been affected. It was her own personal Facebook page, not the school's page. So I think for all of those factors, the court concluded that in this instance, even if this was gratuitously offensive, which they didn't decide it was, it wouldn't automatically be. I think I might.
There we are. John taking a call.
His daughter is calling.
Yeah, there we are.
It's just bouncing on the table.
She's heard what he's saying.
In this particular instance, it wouldn't actually disturb the reputation of the school. Having said that, the court also did say that she was unwise to have reposted this post. They described the original post as being in florid and provocative language. She, in her case, claimed she didn't agree with the language of that post. So, I mean, at one level, you've got to be kind of slightly careful. It's a reminder to all of us, don't repost things that you don't agree with.
Yeah.
You know, so part of the trouble that ended up here is because of the language of the original post that she reposted and then said she didn't agree with the language that was used in that original post. Mm. So there is an element here. It's a right protection of free speech, but it is a balance. And we all need to be very careful about not setting out to gratuitously give offence, certainly not to be grossly offensive, and not to repost things that we actually don't agree with, because we will be assumed to be.
Will this have an impact on other cases? So there's another case reported this week in Evangelical Times. Someone, it seems, in a very similar situation, I forget her name, sorry, in a very similar situation, who has been dismissed at an employment tribunal. Would this appeal case begin to cascade down and have an impact on those other cases?
Well, the case is only individual to her particular circumstances, right. So the legal principles
remain the same. It's not establishing a precedent.
It's then the working out of how do you develop these elements of sort of proportionality. So, of course, there's a high level of judgment involved there. It will help employees in other instances because employers will not be able to dismiss quite as lightly as this.
Yeah.
They'll have to think far more carefully about the issues of whether or not it was genuinely offensive, whether or not it will affect a reputation. So it will make people more cautious to dismiss. And the implication here is that she would be able to go and pursue a remedy for unfair dismissal. So this wasn't an unfair dismissal case, but she may well have a claim for significant compensation from
her
employers.
And she was treated appallingly. I mean, she was sat in a meeting for hours without any representation. She was told she was Nazi-esque. And yeah, I mean, it was extraordinary, really.
Certainly this decision is on the side of free speech and protecting Christians who speak in a personal capacity. If you think of some of the cases, like, for example, the magistrate who said, I don't agree with adopting gay children, it doesn't make any difference to that because that's clearly then connected with the work role that they have. Yeah. So actually, one of the key elements of this decision was that she was saying that she would not bring her views on this into the workplace. So this was something that was done on her private Facebook page. It was her personal opinion. But she had made very clear, I'm not homophobic and I wouldn't bring this into the school and into work. So this is not carte blanche for people to bring their views and their opinions into their employment context in contravention of the policies and positions that an employer has.
Well, brothers, time has gone. But as we finish, let me just ask you, do you have a kitchen island?
I do.
John?
I have a kitchen peninsula, which is not quite an island. It's not completely separated.
Not quite an island.
It's kind of like a bit that goes out into the breakfast area.
We don't have a kitchen island. The reason I ask is apparently that's a marker of whether one feels wealthy, according to an article in The Guardian from earlier this week. If you have a kitchen island or you retire early and you consider yourselves wealthy, we have better news than that in the gospel, don't we?
Yes. See you next time, Phil.
I think it is interesting. And this has been a result of a survey of Gen Z and people thinking, what do you have to be wealthy? And it's in inordinately large amounts of money. And I think this actually reflects something of our culture that people are no longer keeping up with the Joneses, who are their near neighbours, who may have a little bit more, but they're actually looking at the world of social influencers, the kind of papers that are full of stories of the life of the rich and the famous. And so suddenly people's expectations have changed and they have no idea how relatively speaking wealthy they are compared to perhaps even other people in the country or certainly other people around the world. So we've got massively distorted pictures of what it means to be
wealthy. FIC has a kitchen island.
We do.
On that note, on that bombshell.
But you're absolutely right. And from a gospel perspective, we have been blessed with every spiritual blessing in Christ. We don't live for money. We have great wealth, even when we have poverty. I think the gospel just totally reorientates our sense of what we have.
Preach it, brother.
It flips it.
And gratefulness.
Yeah. Flips it on its head. Brothers, thank you so much for talking about some of the things that have been going on in the news this last couple of weeks. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast. Do rate, leave reviews so others can find it. And we'll look forward to speaking to you again very soon. God bless.
Thank you.